The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This course is called The Fate of Freedom in Modern Philosophy. It is one of the graduate courses at the seminary. It has actually been taught here for many years. But now we are continuing with it, and hopefully we'll be able to cover topics that we have not covered in the past. First of all, by way of introduction, let us look at the view of history as the saga of freedom. History has often been understood that way in terms of the emergence of freedom, the increase of freedom. It has been understood then as a saga, or perhaps as an odyssey of freedom. As I said, history has often been understood as the gradual process of man's emancipation, his gradual gaining of freedom, freedom from the bonds of nature. But this idea of freedom is also paired with an idea of man's personality. History has often been interpreted as the gradual emergence of rational, free, autonomous personality from the irrational domination of subhuman powers. Subhuman powers both outside of man and also within man. Now, more specifically, this is the view of history that was fostered by the humanistic Enlightenment. If we think of the Renaissance, of which we shall also be speaking, we think then too of the Enlightenment, in which the humanistic idea of freedom took on a very important and influential form. In fact, this humanistic enlightenment has given modern Western civilization its most characteristic features. It has placed its stamp very heavily on Western civilization. Now, it is Immanuel Kant who, more than any other philosopher, who interpreted the genius of Enlightenment thought. In his essay answering the question of what is Enlightenment, he says this: Aufklärung ist der Ausgang des Menschen aus seiner selbstverschuldeten Unmündigkeit. In other words, Kant defined the Enlightenment as man's emergence from his self-imposed minority. If before the Enlightenment, a man had a childish dependence upon the external props of authority, if he then was still in his minority, if he still had not then come of age, the Enlightenment, Kant taught, had brought men from this childish dependence upon the external props of authority into the adulthood of self-reliance and self-determination. And this adulthood, this self-reliance, was based upon human reason. One may look at this a little more closely. If man, up to this point, had been subjected to a monolithic hegemony, if he had been involved in a situation where there was an ordered, unified system of authority which ruled over him, if there had been a system in which everything was believed to have its place within a hierarchical order, if everything then, how one was to believe, how he was to act, how he would plan to meet his destiny, was imposed from above or imposed from outside. Now man was summoned to take his destiny into his own hands and to make his own decisions. And he was to do this then on the basis of his inalienable right, the inalienable right that is his as a rational being. Indeed, Kant expressed the genius of Enlightenment thought. Now, preeminently, it is this rationalistic Enlightenment point of view that has spawned the linear evolutionistic conceptions of history that have been so characteristic of the modern mind. Of course, evolution and evolutionistic conceptions are very much with us. And we often think of evolutionary positions coming out of the study of scientific data, coming out of the study of biology and biological data, for example, or possibly out of the study of astronomy, whatever it may be. But if we think of a very typical form of evolutionary thinking, we can find that it has roots in the rationalistic Enlightenment view. I speak here of a linear point of view. One can get an idea of what I am speaking about if he should draw a line, a horizontal line, maybe a couple of inches long, and then under it, somewhat down from it, place some very much shorter vertical lines, three or four of them. And then from the first vertical line, the one to the far left, draw a straight line up toward the horizontal line. Draw it slantwise from left to right, pointing up toward the horizontal line. We shall have occasion to refer to this this figure later on. But it is a pattern within which much thinking takes place. That man then is able to transcend, he is able to move toward a goal, to move away from his present situation, which we have then indicated by these vertical lines, and move in a straight line toward an ideal, a linear idea, a linear idea of progress. And it is a rationalistic Enlightenment view that has aided and abetted such a linear evolutionary conception of history that has been so characteristic of the modern mind. Now, we may admit, the Christian faith played a part in introducing mankind to a linear view of history. It certainly played a part in freeing thought from the cyclic view of history of ancient civilization. We find such a change over in the thought of Aurelius Augustine, the church father Augustine, where Augustine purposely broke away, he consciously broke away from a cyclic view of history that had been very prominent in before and was also prominent in his time. And Augustine insisted on the once-for-allness of the events of the scriptures. God then once created the world. God sent his Son into the world once and for all. There will be an end of all things where once and for all history will come to its climax, and we shall be ushered into the new heavens and the new earth. Indeed, the Christian faith, and we may say notably through Augustine, played a part in freeing thought from the cyclic view of history of ancient civilization, where history was thought to go in huge cycles. There were beginnings of these cycles. It reached its apogee and then fall away again. And man was then supposed to be able to understand his own time, which of course also would be cyclical by studying these cycles of the past. However, with all this, the characteristically modern conceptions of history, with their optimistic reliance on immanent historical forces, are rather the children of Enlightenment thought than of Christianity. If we simply do not put it in these terms, that a linear view of history has replaced a cyclic view of history, but if we look deeper, if we look into the situation, a bit more fully, then we can see that there is a very different view. The Christianity has a very different view than that of the Enlightenment. Because in Enlightenment thought, there is the idea that there are immanent historical forces at work. The emphasis falls on immanent historical forces. And in terms of these, it is possible then to have an optimistic point of view. Now I say that the modern conceptions of history then, with their optimistic reliance on immanent historical forces, are rather the children of Enlightenment thought than of Christianity. When we look at this Enlightenment view with this optimistic cachet, we know that it has been subjected to criticism, even very severe criticism. Such criticism arose, for example, after the First World War shocked the confidence of pre-war expectations. It has been said that the 20th century did not really begin at the year 1900, but at the beginning of the First World War in 1914. There had been, it is acknowledged, an optimistic point of view, that it was thought that the course of mankind was onward and upward. It was thought that there was really nothing that could shake this confidence in a very basic way. But then came the First World War, and it had then really, truly, a cataclysmic influence. And there arose a spate of criticism of a optimistic, linear point of view. This criticism rose especially after the First World War shock, the confidence of pre-war expectations, and such criticism also continued on during the Second World War and into the period after the Second World War. But nevertheless, in spite of such criticism, these Enlightenment ideals are still deeply embedded in our culture. They are not that easily eradicated. In fact, in spite of all the criticism, they are very much at work. They can be seen today in a very pure form, for example, in the Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations. And from time to time, as a more pessimistic point of view gives place to a more optimistic point of view, for whatever reason, such Enlightenment ideals again come to the surface. Indeed, these ideals are now enjoying a renaissance. Even, let's say, a more optimistic point of view is even present in theology. And that might be regarded as remarkable because for many years, theology and theologians had been the source of much of the contemporary criticism of the Enlightenment view of history. But if we look at this Enlightenment ideal of human freedom more closely, we see that it emerged not in isolation, but within an entire constellation of ideas. If we look at the idea of freedom, we have then to associate a fair number of other ideas with it. This ideal of human freedom did not emerge in isolation. It emerged then within an entire constellation of ideas. For one thing, within this way of thinking, human freedom was intimately associated with the right and with the ability of individual self-determination. Within this idea of freedom, man then has the right of self-determination. Man has then not only the right, but if he has the right, he also has the ability of self-determination, the ability to determine himself. We see, of course, in very recent times, this idea of self-determination in the right to life issue, or as over against the pro-lifers and those who are in favor, as it is said, in human choice, who are then pro-choice. One of the ideas associated with this is that a woman has a right of self-determination. What is in her body belongs to her. It is part within her body, yet it belongs to her, and she has the right then of determination over what shall happen to this fetus within her. Self-determination, not only the right, but the ability of self-determination. And this idea of self-determination is inextricably connected with this Enlightenment view of freedom, and we shall then be returning to this again and again. Now, this idea of self-determination, in turn, was intimately connected with the idea of human personality. What is it that constitutes a person, a personality, that gives one a personality? What belongs to the idea of personality? Certainly, that one has this right and this ability of self-determination. And furthermore, if one is self-determining, then this must be regarded as an essential ingredient of personality. Indeed, the birth of freedom was supposed to mark the liberation of personality from the bonds of external domination, from the bonds of external restraint. And as I said a while back here, this restraint then can be within one himself or outside of himself in the sense of coming from nature or from other persons, whatever that may be. But personality then, freedom, is understood then in terms of liberation from the bonds of external domination. I might add that when we look at what as external and internal in this point of view, that is very, very tied up with the idea of freedom and personality and self-determination. Because, as we shall see, something is external when it does not flow out of, when it is not then related intrinsically to one's self-determination, to one's ability to establish, to control his own destiny. It is something that stands outside of himself in this way of thinking as a personality. Now, this respect for human personality, again, was related to the idea of the infinite worth of the individual. This idea of infinite worth is also very characteristic of the Enlightenment view of freedom. This simply means that if one has an infinite worth, his worth does not then arise from any connection in which he stands, any relationship in which he stands. His worth does not depend then on his ability to produce goods and services. His personality does not then depend upon his, well, in final analysis, even on his serving God and doing what God would ask of him, doing things out of love for God, let us say. But that his personality has worth in itself. That is, it has not a limited worth depending on something outside of itself, but that its worth resides in itself, that its worth then is of infinite character. And this respect for human personality then was based on the infinite worth of the individual. Now, in this way of thinking, human worth was not founded, as in Christianity, on the truth of man's creation in the image of God. Indeed, in the Christian position, there is a very strong idea, there's a very strong sense of human worth. But human worth in the Christian faith is founded in the scriptural teaching that man is created in the image of God. But in Enlightenment thought, human worth came to be founded, they thought, in something that was more intrinsically human. If then one is human, because he is created in the image of God, that in this line of thinking is interpreted in this way, that man then is worthy, he has worth because of something outside of his own personality. Namely, that he has been created, he has been made in the image of God. And in Enlightenment thought, and we shall see also in Renaissance thought, it was thought that the worth of man had to be founded in something that was more specifically human, more intrinsically human than that which could be found in the Christian point of view. One can say, and I certainly would say that, that this way of interpreting Christianity, the Christian view of creation, rests on a misunderstanding. But nevertheless, this is the way many people think. This is the way that this congeries of ideas was developed. Now, the foundation, this more intrinsically human foundation, was thought to be reason. And we may write reason here, the word reason with a capital R, because it is not simply reason in the sense of our being able to reason about things, to ratiocinate about things, but reason in a deeper sense, reason in a, well, sometimes it is even thought that it is a divine reason within us. At least it belongs then very centrally to the idea of who man is, and one might spell it with a capital R. Now, it is then in what makes man specifically human, in the nature of man as a rational being, that one finds the guarantee of his human dignity and worth, and the hope of his increasing emancipation from the recalcitrant forces he yet discovers within himself and in nature around him. This then, according to the humanistic Enlightenment point of view. If we think then of the emancipation of man, if we think then of the freeing of man, then it is then in what makes him specifically human that we have to search then. We have to search for in what makes man specifically human for the foundation of his emancipation. It is then in his rational nature, in the nature of man as a rational being, that we find then the foundation for his emancipation, for this gradual freeing. And it is here, then, that one finds the guarantee of human dignity. One finds the guarantee of human worth. It is in his specifically human nature, in his rational nature, that one finds the source of human dignity, the foundation of human dignity, and also of human worth. And it is here that one finds the hope of man's increasing emancipation from those forces which still bear in upon him and hold him back. We might think of ones who are in the high hurdles, and they have then to surmount these barriers in order to finish the race. And as man, according to this view, continues on, then he is still faced with all kinds of hurdles. There are hurdles that stand in the way of his growing freedom, both outside in nature and within himself, and he must overcome these. And so, I say this, it is in what made man specifically human, It is in the nature of man as a rational being that one discovered at once the guarantee of man's human dignity and worth and the hope of his increasing emancipation from the recalcitrant forces he yet discovered within himself and in nature round about him. But now, if concern for human freedom has been so important in our Western civilization, if the Enlightenment view of freedom has placed its cachet on our Western civilization, it has left a very strong imprint on Western civilization, it is all the more remarkable that in spite of all the astounding advances this civilization has made in scientific discovery and in technological control, the problems of human freedom and human personality and human worth are still very much with us in our Western world. We just have to think a few moments of some of the astounding advances of our time. The moonwalk, the vast increase in the speed of communication, the revolution connected with computers and the information explosion, all these things. One can understand or at least see what is going on in the world, even at great distances, much better than his forebears could. Whether that means that he understands things better is a different question. But nevertheless, we are faced on every side, we are confronted on every side with the results of vast technological change, technological advances, and we are promised that this pace of technological discovery and technological change will increase rather than diminish in the future. But with all this, one might expect then that mankind has been given the tools to better his condition, that with all this, it might be thought that we could go onward and upward in a linear way, approaching then an ideal of a humanity that is at peace and in prosperity, where mankind's basic problems have been overcome. But in face of all this, we have found that the questions of human freedom, human personality, and human worth are still very much with us. It is not long ago that there was the domination in Europe by the Nazis. And paired with that, the fascist regimes to the south. There was a great world war as a consequence of the Nazi attempt to reach out to form a third a kingdom, or Dritte Reich, and to reach out and to engage in world conquest. Eclipse of human freedom in totalitarian states. But we do not have to look that far back. There is the constant difficulty around the Berlin Wall, the wall between the East and the West, and the questions that arise from persecution, the slaughter of anyone who tries to escape over that wall. There is the restriction of human freedom in a totalitarian state. Well, not only that, but we have experienced challenge to human freedom in totalitarian programs of social planning. There are those who would engage in widespread genetic engineering, if one kind or another, even very simple or exceedingly refined, in order then to increase the quality, the biological quality of mankind. Is this then, it can be argued that this is just then in the interest of human advance, in human freedom, but it has also been regarded as an assault on human freedom, a challenge to human freedom. Such things have been experienced as challenge to human freedom, as totalitarian programs of social planning. And furthermore, human dignity and worth, that has been complained, are being sacrificed at the altar of the machine age. Some of us can remember when Charlie Chaplin's movie Modern Times came out. And I remember one episode in there that I thought was very telling, that Charlie is working at the in the assembly line, and he's turning nut number such and such, and he is doing that all day, and so that when he leaves the factory at night, he still has his wrench in his hand, and his arm is still moving as if he were turning this nut. Well, that was an early protest against what is often called the rationalization of production, at least the dehumanizing effects of such rationalization. And we know too that there are definite experiments going on so that these dehumanizing tendencies will be overcome. There are clusters of workers who are working on one automobile in some factories, and that they are then able to do different jobs. Their jobs vary more than would be the case in a straight line assembly situation. Well, it has been complained, and complained very widely, that human dignity and worth are being sacrificed at the altar of the machine age. It is also said that human self-determination is threatened by the astounding complexity of our situation, civilization rather, by the increase of technical competency required for decision-making. People have felt themselves alienated from the centers of human planning, and they have felt then that they've been discouraged because they find it difficult to believe that they have anything really to do with the decision making, that things are going on around about them with which they have very little to do. Their lives are being ordered for them, and therefore they begin to fail in their self-esteem. Well, human self-determination has often been thought to be threatened by the astounding complexity of our civilization, by the increase of technical competency required for decision making. There's also the overwhelming influence of the mass media. One might ask whether he is simply being manipulated by the mass media in order then to make him into the proper kind of consumer. Whether one feels that way or not about advertising on television or in the paper and the magazines, this has been brought up many times, that human personality is challenged by the overwhelming influence of the mass medium. And the absolute worth of the individual, it has been complained, has been undermined in contemporary society, where one's value is measured in terms of the contribution he can make to the social fabric of a massified culture. Is one's worth dependent on what his economic contribution? What is it? Is there a massified culture in which one belongs, a culture that's been massified as it has then been influenced, as it has been then manipulated by those in control? This question has often been asked. In fact, it is asked, was asked in the former century by Soren Kierkegaard, who reacted strongly to the massification of culture. Now, in all this, men have experienced a sense of alienation and dereliction. In short, many have spoken of a crisis of the ideals which impelled Enlightenment man. And these ideals, which have had such a profound influence on our modern Western humanistic civilization. Now, the attempt has often been made to understand this crisis within the confines of a linear view of history, to understand the difficulties which to many minds have come to crisis proportion. Within the very scheme of this linear transcending, this linear view of history of which I spoke. Along these lines, the failure to realize the Enlightenment ideals is laid at the door of the still recalcitrant forces which hinder man in his steady upward climb. The difficulty then is that the hurdles have been too high, or man has not yet come strong enough to surmount them and to finish his race. Now, sociologists often ascribe these failures to what is called cultural lag. In American sociology, the idea of cultural lag was developed by William F. Ogburn. I refer to his book, Social Change, which was published in New York in 1922. At least in American sociology, this idea of cultural lag was introduced then by William F. Ogburn, O-G-B-U-R-N. It is often said in this context, speaking of cultural lag, that spiritual progress has fallen behind material progress. We see, of course, the tremendous advances in material progress. We see the tremendous advances in the obtaining of goods and services. We see the tremendous technological advances of which I have spoken. But spiritual progress, the progress of man as a spiritual being, then has fallen behind this material progress. And it is often said that the gap must be narrowed by using methods of social planning. Sometimes methods which approximate those which have been used with such success in the scientific investigation of nature. The point is often made that it's this way, that if there has been such an advance in the scientific realm, in the technological realm, why then should we not take these same methods which have shown themselves to be so helpful there and apply them to man in his social life? Or we might say in a very broad sense then, his spiritual life, so that we can overcome then this lag, that his spiritual life has lagged behind his material life, that it has not then been able to catch up yet. Now, in such a fashion, it is thought that the hindrances may be removed to a large extent, and mankind will be able to move steadily upward along the path to freedom. But now, in starting this lecture, I said that this course is called The Fate of Freedom. Indeed, if that be the case, I must refer to something more sinister. I must then have in mind a more sinister interpretation of the crisis which has faced the humanistic idea of man's freedom, dignity, and worth. Now, when I mean, when we use the word sinister, I'm not referring to anything that, refers to the underworld or to some dark cosmic powers or something of the sort like that. But I'm trying to say that we are not going to follow the lead of many and to try to understand the difficulties that arise in the humanistic idea of freedom simply in terms of the height of the obstacles that have confronted man, the difficulties that have confronted him, the still recalcitrant forces that are outside of him and within him. We are not going to be looking at things within a linear point of view, but we shall take a different position. Shall not speak then of simply obstacles to freedoms, but I shall speak then of the fate of freedom. We shall be dealing with this again next time, but just to anticipate, let me speak of a few ideas here. Instead of picturing human freedom then in a titanic struggle against the dead weight of external recalcitrant forces, I am suggesting that there is a problem that resides within the humanistic idea of freedom itself. And so we get the situation that you do not have the picture then of man struggling higher and higher to freedom, overcoming the forces then which are outside of himself, outside simply of the center of his personality, outside of this idea of human freedom and dignity, but that there is something in the humanistic idea of human freedom and dignity itself that makes for the problem. And so we get this situation, that the more we have a clear, the more we have a pure idea of human freedom, human reason, human self-determination from a humanistic point of view, the more we can expect that problems will arise. As I said, therefore, I do not speak here of a linear view of history. Instead, I speak of the fate of freedom in modern philosophy, and an analysis of that fate of freedom is what we shall then be involved in this course.